millions of dollars spent cleaning up the keys after Hurricane Irma when they didn't have to be? Engaging with one communist dictator, but not another. And will Miami get professional soccer before it hosts some World Cup matches? Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. In the days after Irma swept through the Lower Keys, the state of Florida stepped in and signed deals for companies to pick up the debris, but at higher prices than the local cleanup contracts that were already in place. The governor says action needed to be taken to clean up the Keys. This week, President Trump met with the North Korean dictator and the two signed a joint statement. But the administration has had a much different strategy with the communist dictatorship in this hemisphere, Cuba. And Miami could be among the host cities for the World Cup when it comes to North America in 2026. So how about Major League Soccer in the Magic City? The Florida Roundup with your phone calls is next. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. 2 days after Hurricane Irma barreled through the Lower Keys, the state of Florida asked for companies to bid on work cleaning up the debris, only there were local deals already in place. The state chose two companies to pick up the mess, costing taxpayers up to $30 million extra, according to an investigation released this week by CBS4 in Miami. Governor Rick Scott defends his administration's actions, saying Monroe County requested the help, but under oath, the county's emergency manager, said the county did not make a formal request. Scott tells CBS4 the state stepped in when companies with the pre-Irma contracts didn't show up.
So we did our job. We showed up. We opened up US-1. We got people back to work. We got people back to their homes as quickly as we can. It is, I can't imagine, these same special interests now are sitting there trying to say there's somehow, when they don't do their job, that the state somehow didn't save money when we saved an unbelievable amount of money for the citizens of our state.
Did the state save time and money by stepping in and putting these contracts in place? If you live in the Keys, what was your experience like trying to get the storm debris picked up? Maybe you worked on the storm cleanup in the Keys. What was that like? And did the state just Bigfoot its way to spending millions of dollars it didn't have to? Let us know your thoughts here as we begin the Florida Roundup with you at 800-743-WLRN, our call and toll-free number across all of South Florida from the Keys to the Trees up in Jupiter, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN. Jim DeFede is back with us, the investigative reporter for CBS4 in Miami. He is the one behind the investigation with the CBS local affiliate. He joins us from those studios. Jim, what cleanup contracts were in place in the Keys before Irma?
So there were a number of contracts. Actually, Monroe County had its own contract that it had bid out long before the storm and had in place. The State Department of Transportation had six contracts with companies ready to do debris removal. And the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers had a contract as well with companies to do work. So the governor had options if he wanted to take the responsibility for doing the cleanup. He could have let Monroe County do it. He could have done the state. But he chose none of those contracts. And 2 days after the storm, as you noted, put out, it wasn't even an open competitive bid. It was an invitation to bid sent to a handful of companies on 2 days after the storm. And as a result, you ended up with companies being selected to do the debris removal work when there were companies already in place ready and willing to do it. And let me just give you an example of the prices we're talking about and how you get to that $30 million number. So MCM and Community Asphalt are two of the companies that were given the emergency contract. MCM charged the state, charged taxpayers, $913 a mile to sweep curbs and gutters. Bergeron Emergency Services, which had its own contract with the state that the state ignored, was willing to do that work for $12. So you were paying $913 a mile to sweep curbs and gutters when another company said that they were ready, willing, and able to do it for $12.
Jim, did the contracts that were in place before Irma, though, provide for the scale of the cleanup necessary that the storm wrought?
Yeah, and here's absolutely, because here's the misnomer. None of the companies actually have like 600 truck employees. Well, the companies are managers. They manage the contracts. They have subcontractors that come in and do the work. So what you and the irony is that MCM, for instance, had no debris removal experience. Ashbritt, a company that did have the cleanup responsibility for the Keys, that was, as you phrased, big-footed by the governor, they're a national firm that has been doing this work going back to Hurricane Katrina. So you had companies ready to do it at far lower prices, and yet the governor went the more expensive route.
The concern that the governor had voiced to you, and I'll let you continue in a minute, the concern the governor has voiced in all of this was that the capacity just wasn't there, because a lot of these trucks, a lot of these subcontractors were already busy cleaning up after Hurricane Harvey. Because Irma was such a whole state storm encompassing the entire peninsula of Florida, all of these communities demanding these cleanup trucks get on the streets ASAP, that the state moved in when these local contracts weren't being fulfilled.
So let's take that point. And that's the point that the governor made in the clip that you had. If you had continued paying the clip, what you would have heard was me then saying to the governor, name the companies. What companies on September 12th refuse or said they are unable or unwilling to do the work? And the governor could not come up
with
an answer.
Right. Yeah.
He said that he would get back to me, his office would get back to me.
Has he?
Still waiting.
Okay.
Still do not have the answers. In fact, I can tell you that is not true. That is a lie. I have the companies on record at the time saying we were ready to do the work. We want to do the work. Monroe County Commission specifically, I've got a copy of their meeting that we're going to be playing this Sunday on my show, Facing South Florida, in which commissioners are saying the state needs to get out. They're interfering with our own contractor. And to your point earlier about because the storm was so large and you already had Harvey and you had Maria coming on the edge, didn't you need to do this? No, this actually slowed debris removal efforts, because really what you do is there are only so many trucks and crews available. And so by the state going in and paying these exorbitant rates to MCM and Community Asphalt, what it did was companies that had subcontractors and crews ready to clean up in Isle Mirada or Coral Gables or in Plantation suddenly lost those crews because they all quit to go down and work for MCM Asphalt at much higher prices. So it just shifted resources to this one area and forced the state to pay rates that they never should have had to pay.
All this began on September 12th with this request for proposal from the state. And I want to read to you, Jim, what you've already seen from the governor's office and the governor's response to your reporting. They released a mission documentation that was dated, I believe it's September 12th, at 2:16 in the afternoon on September 12th. So less than 48 hours after Hurricane Irma came through Cudjoe Key and Big Pine Key in the Lower Keys area. And it talks about the CERT chief. This is the State Emergency Response Team chief. Discussion directly with the Monroe County Emergency Manager Director. And the county, quote, grants the state Florida Department of Transportation permission to clear any and all roads necessary to assist with the proactive actions, public safety, emergency needs in the Keys. Your reporting has discovered this deposition, this under oath statement from the Emergency Management Director of Monroe County, asked whether or not they requested this state assistance.
That's right. And in fact, he says under oath, they did not make that request. So it's important to even understand what they're referring to in that document that you referenced. Here's the way it went down. On September 12th, the storm hits on the 10th. On September 12th at 10 a.m., the Monroe County Emergency Manager is having a conversation with his counterpart in Tallahassee. And they say, look, we've finished clearing US-1. Now we're going to start working our way into the neighborhoods. You know, and so the DOT and the state emergency manager says to him, he says, look, we've got some extra crews down there already available since they've finished clearing US-1. Would you like them to help you clear some of the roads into the neighborhoods? And the Marty Centerfit, the emergency manager, said, yeah, that would be great. Clearing roads is something that takes a day or two. It's called cut and toss. Literally, you cut the trees and branches and you toss them to the side of the road. It has nothing to do with the 4 or 5 months that ended up ensuing on debris removal. That was an entirely different thing. And yet somehow, between the time of that phone call and when the bids went out for this emergency contract, somebody got to somebody, and that's the missing piece of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Who spoke to who? Was it the transportation department, the governor's office? Who manipulated this crisis to benefit a handful of companies?
Speaking with Jim Defeatie, investigative reporter for CBS 4 News in Miami with his investigation into the state contracts after Hurricane Irma, in the hours after Hurricane Irma, to clean the debris in Monroe County. Your phone calls, 800-743-9576. Did you experience this directly? Maybe you were part of those crews helping clean up. Maybe you're among those neighbors that waited for days, if not weeks, for your neighborhood in the Keys to get cleaned up. We'll go to line one here with Stephen in Homestead. Go ahead, Stephen. You're on the radio.
Hi, thanks for having me. And to Jim, great reporter. Great reporter, sir. I live in the in Homestead, so we're right there going into the Keys. I came back through the storm back on that Monday to come back and help with the disaster recovery. And the state that I saw and the Fed all got together, Congressman Curbelo, Governor Scott, and all the county commissioners, Daniela Levine-Cava. They did a great job with the Keys to try to open it up for US-1 to get recovery crews down there from what we saw in Homestead. And I was also, I went through Big Pine Key and other places with the church group to help clear debris like a week after the storm, mm-hmm. When they started letting in crews to help clean it up. And while it was devastating, the state did respond immediately, but I do want to hear more about what Jim DeFitte has to say on the investigation.
Gotcha, Steve. Thank you. Your assessment there. You thought the state did respond immediately. Jim, your thoughts on what Steve's talking about there?
Yeah, let me look. I think that there was a belief and a desire to want to help the folks in the Keys. There is no doubt about that. It was necessary. The question becomes whether or not the governor acted reasonably in lining up the crews to do the work. And let me give you another example. I cited the sweeping curbs and gutters. Mm-hmm. This is an even more egregious one. For every stove or dishwasher or washing machine that had to be hauled away because of the damage in Hurricane Irma, MCM, UNIA Construction Management, MCM, charged the state under their emergency contract with the governor $969 for every appliance, every stove, every dishwasher, every washing machine. The other companies that were already pre-selected to do the work were willing to do it for between $48 and $75. For $969, you could have not only hauled away the stove or the refrigerator or the washing machine, you could have replaced and bought everyone in the Keys new ones for each of that price.
Yeah.
That one line item cost the state $4 million in wasteful spending.
And for those of us who spent time in the Lower Keys, lived in the Lower Keys, you saw mile after mile after mile of those appliances lining up on the overseas highways in the days and weeks after the storm. Did the job get done? Did it get done, Jim? Were these contracts, even at these much higher prices, were they fulfilled?
They were ultimately fulfilled. Look, the question isn't, and by the way, let me be clear. I'm not saying MCM or Community Asphalt did anything illegal. If the state was willing to pay them an outrageous fee to do the work, good for them to be able to take it. The question is whether the governor used his resources properly. And clearly, the evidence that I've uncovered shows that they were not thinking this through. And that's the problem that we've got here. But yes, was the work done? Yes. I think it took longer because of this, because the crews ended up getting shifted around. And I think other parts of South Florida were delayed in getting cleaned up because so many crews immediately shifted to the section between mile markers 16 and 40. It was a gold rush down there because they were getting paid two and three times more to work there than the rest of the Florida Keys and the rest of South Florida. So I think in the long run, it hurt all of South Florida. But yes, the work did eventually get done.
An important note that you make there, not alleging any legal activity here, but certainly just these egregious numbers that you've uncovered in these contracts compared to what the contracts were paying that were in place before Irma. What about the FEMA reimbursement for the debris cleanup that comes from the Federal Emergency Management Agency?
That's an excellent question. So the state is spending all this money for the debris removal with the anticipation that they will submit the bills to FEMA and that the federal government will reimburse the state for the cost of the cleanup. Well, we contacted FEMA and we asked them about this emergency contract. And what they said was, look, these are unique situations that we'll evaluate, but we have not made any decision about whether or not we will reimburse the state of Florida for these costs until we review the process, look at the contracts, look at the decisions that were made in granting these contracts. So right now, there is a possibility that the federal government may not reimburse the state for this cleanup, which means that the state taxpayers will ultimately be on the hook for it. Either way, it's going to be taxpayers, whether it's U.S. taxpayers overall or Florida taxpayers. But yes, there is a possibility. Is that likely to happen? I don't know. It's an election year, and it's hard to imagine that the Trump administration, through its FEMA director, would embarrass Rick Scott, you know, in the middle of an election for the United States Senate by denying the claims. But we'll have to wait and see.
Meantime, we are in the middle of June, a hurricane season already underway. Do the local contracts, are they in force in the Keys, the same contracts that apparently were ignored by the state last September?
They are, because that's good planning. That's what you're supposed to do. FEMA and even the governor says that you should have pre-positioned contracts. Here's the real irony. At the same time the governor put forward this emergency contract to pay these exorbitant rates, he was requiring, demanding, telling every other city and county in the state of Florida to hold their pre-existing contractors responsible, make them do the work for the prices they agreed to before the storm. He made everyone else in the state abide by their pre-existing contracts, but that wasn't good enough for him. He played by a different set of rules when it came to that section of the Florida Keys around Cudjoe. And it still is not clear why. And when he says to me that it saved the state money, I asked him, how can he say that? And he doesn't have an answer because it cost the state money.
Jim DeFede, investigative reporter for CBS4 in Miami. More on Jim's program, Facing South Florida, on Sunday morning. Jim, always great to have you on the Florida Roundup. Thanks for sharing your reporting with us. Still to come on our program, stick with us. Two communist dictators, two different foreign policy strategies with implications here in South Florida. Do you support President Trump's meeting with the head of North Korea this week while trying to isolate Cuba's communist leaders? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576, when the Roundup continues after this. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. It was 1 year ago Saturday when President Trump came to Miami to announce he was rolling back some of the Obama-era changes of America's Cuban policy. And in doing so, Trump went after the communist dictatorship on the island.
And now that I am your president, America will expose the crimes of the Castro regime and stand with the Cuban people in their struggle for freedom. Because we know it is best for America to have freedom in our hemisphere, whether in Cuba or Venezuela, and to have a future where the people of each country can live out their own dreams.
While working to isolate Cuba, this week President Trump met with a different communist despot, Kim Jong-un of North Korea. And after their summit in Singapore, the president called this dictator talented.
Well, he is very talented. Anybody that takes over a situation like he did at 26 years of age and is able to run it and run it tough. I don't say he was nice or I don't say anything about it. He ran it. Very few people at that age, you can take one out of 10,000 probably couldn't do it.
Two dictators, 1 year apart, one half a world away with nuclear capabilities, the other off our shore, whose rule has influenced our community, our culture, our politics for decades. So what do you make of the difference in how President Trump has approached North Korea and how he has dealt with Cuba? What about those who criticize President Obama for meeting with Raul Castro in Havana? Are they holding Trump to the same standard? This week, the president said this on North Korea.
They have great beaches. You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right?
So if real estate potential helps guide American foreign policy, what about the sands of Cuba? 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Foreign policy, a local story for us here in South Florida, no doubt about it. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Fabiola Santiago is a columnist for our partner, the Miami Herald. And David Adams is a senior editor for Univision. Fabiola and David, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Same to you, Tim. But let's start here. Is this inconsistency or is it flexibility.
It's neither. It's hypocrisy. You cannot, particularly in Latin America, if you're trying to win over Latin Americans, you can't keep following this policy, this inconsistent, as you said, hypocritical policy that says engaging Asian communism, whether it's China, Vietnam, North Korea, is somehow good, but yet engaging Cuban communism is somehow evil. When you send that kind of hypocritical message to Latin Americans, what happens is they see it not only as you sort of pushing around a small communist island in the region, they see it as an indicator of how you treat the entire region, which is why it's always been so hard for the United States to get Latin American governments on board when we're trying to pursue diplomatic initiatives like, for example, right now, targeted economic sanctions against Venezuela.
Venezuela, yeah. Fabiola, do you see it the same way? Does the actions and the words from the president in regards to North Korea just this week, Fabiola, damage somehow the American efforts in Venezuela, for instance?
Yes, I think it's extreme hypocrisy to treat both dictators differently. But U.S.-Cuba policy is driven by South Florida politics, while North Koreans have no thought. And with North Korea, there was no thought given to the victims of the regime. And that's because you don't have North Koreans voting in, you know, refugees and whatever, immigrants who've become U.S. citizens voting in U.S. elections. And I think that's where the difference lies.
One other difference, David, is the nuclear threat, isn't it? We can't discount that.
Well, that's certainly true. And obviously part of the strategy of Kim Jong-un was to reach this point with nuclear weapons at his disposal. It does make him a much more serious threat, and there is obviously a case for saying, well, better to have Donald Trump, our president, as his friend than his enemy. Maybe he's less likely to use his weapons. But I think, you know, your clip said it all when President Trump referred to democracy in our hemisphere. He obviously considers our hemisphere differently from North Korea. And as Fabiola said, there's the issue of who votes here. But there's also the issue of it's a scary threat that's much further away.
Right, but is he sending the message then to Latin America that they need to militarize, that they need to acquire weapons of mass destruction to be taken seriously by the United States government?
Well, there's certainly that, and the other thing that one should perhaps remember is that while it may be hypocritical, it's not entirely inconsistent. After all, the United States has had a very different policy towards communist China for decades than it has had with communist Cuba.
That's been certainly driven by the economic power that,
well,
that China
right.
represents.
But what you're saying to Latin Americans is, though, we're not confronting China because we know we can't. But we're pushing around Cuba because we know we can.
But I know that Trump supporters now are saying, look at what's happened today on this Friday with the Trump administration announcing tariffs to $50 billion worth of Chinese goods, China responding in kind, Tim, so that right. there is significant pushback with this Trump administration in regards to trade activities in China.
With regards to trade. But whenever you see a really blatant human rights abuse in China, you really don't see the likes of Marco Rubio or Mario Diaz-Balart coming out and saying, hey, you know, we should be, establishing an economic embargo against Beijing. It doesn't happen. But whenever you see, you know, some dissidents jailed in Cuba, hysterics break out. And again, that inconsistency, that hypocrisy really rankles the rest of Latin America.
And so the legacy here, Fabiola, when it comes to this inconsistency, not the Trump administration certainly is not the first American administration to have inconsistencies in its foreign policy when it comes to even this hemisphere. The supporters will call it flexibility. The critics may call it hypocrisy or inconsistency. But as the Trump administration has practiced it, is it any different?
Well, yes. I mean, I think that human rights principles should guide American foreign policy. I think it is one of the things that sets us apart from everyone else in the world. Everyone else in, not in the Western world, but But, you know, every country that we're trying to bring forward, you know, into the 21st century, including Cuba. And I don't criticize people for, you know, people for calling out Cuba on human rights. I do criticize the lack of consistency in the way that we approach our relations with them. There is no reason for the United States not to be engaging Cuba, none whatsoever. And you know, one of I remember that so many of the things that were criticized about what Obama did, mm-hmm. and they pale, any sort of overly friendly gesture that Obama had pales in comparison to what Trump has done with Kim.
Let's talk about this, because in South Florida, we can't help but compare and contrast. December 2014, the Obama administration begins its overture to opening up Cuba. March 2016, the president, a sitting president for the first time in 90-some years, goes to Havana, mm-hmm. Meets with Raul Castro face-to-face in Havana. They held a really extraordinary, remarkable press conference with the two of them together. And now here, watching a world away, a separate president, a different president, engaging in a kind of a neutral territory with another despot.
Yeah, but let's be clear here. The hypocrisy does not have to do with Trump engaging North Korea. I think, you know, David and I would agree that most foreign correspondents of our age would agree that engaging, for the U.S. to engage its foes, is good. It's productive when there's an opening. Trump found an opening, and he's doing that. But by the same token, the playbook should say that even when you engage, you know, these monstrous dictatorial foes like Kim, like the Castro regime, you should also do it while calling out their abuses, which Obama did in 2016 when he visited Havana. You and I were both sitting there mm-hmm. listening to his speech. Yep. Whereas Trump was saying, oh, Kim loves his people and they love him, Obama, you know, had the brass to stand up in front of Castro and everyone on public TV in Cuba and say, don't be afraid of your own people. Start giving them the rights they deserve. I mean, there's a world of difference between his performance in Havana and Trump's in Singapore.
Exactly.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The level of sophistication of Obama's visit to Cuba was extraordinary. The speech that he delivered in Cuba to broadcast, at his insistence, broadcast live to the Cuban population by radio was extraordinary. And you compare that to the sycophantic way in which President Trump dealt with Kim Jong-un. That was pretty extraordinary. There was no message, obviously, to the North Korean people about American values.
Foreign policy, the Trump administration in relation to two communist countries, North Korea this week, and what we've seen over the past year with Cuba. That's what we're talking about here on the Florida Roundup with Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's correspondent, David Adams, you just heard from him, senior editor at Univision, and Fabiola Santiago, columnist with our partner, the Miami Herald. You can join our conversation, 800-743-9576. What have you seen? What have you experienced in relation to the Trump administration engagement or efforts toward more isolation with Cuba and the ruling party and the rulers there? 800-743-9576. And what about implications as Venezuela continues to see its economy fall apart and the United States putting more sanctions on the Venezuelan government and other Venezuelans? Let's go to your phone calls at 800-743-9576 in Miami. We'll begin with Laz. Laz, you're on the radio. Thanks for calling this week.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've been selling bespoke trips to Cuba since 1994, introducing the country from a real perspective, not from the perspective of the Cuban political machine here in Miami. And now the Mario Diaz-Balart and Ross Letton and even just President Trump in that recording you just played, they're always saying we stand by the Cuban people. But they also follow that with more embargo rules or referencing the embargo. And people in Cuba, trust me, they keep saying, we don't want the United States to stand by us. because when you stand by us, you know, it doesn't bring us any good to your nation, to the United States. Politicians say we want to stand by the Cuban people, but, you know, they're saying, please, please don't. And then my other comment is, it's just very ironic that we buy hundreds of thousands of, I think, barrels of oil a week from Venezuela, and we're accusing them of violating human rights. And then we have a president who says Russia is Vladimir Putin is a great leader. He admires him.
Help me understand your linkage here between buying petroleum and our criticism of human rights. American can't do both.
Well, not why we're saying that Cuba is violating, you know, human rights, and, you know, Korea and China are the biggest violators of human rights. We can't claim that with Cuba. It's an old story. And if it's so true, then we should stop buying oil from Venezuela.
Laz, we appreciate your thoughts. Thanks for joining the conversation. Appreciate
sure.
it. Laz in Miami there, 800-743-9576. Pedro in Miami, you are up next on the Florida Roundup. Go ahead, Pedro. You're on the radio.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to reinforce the comments that the stark difference between the two presidents and the right and the wrong way to deal with governments that abuse human rights. I think President Obama was a shining example on how to have constructive engagement while at the same time, as one of you mentioned, calling out the regime, meeting with the dissidents. Was it a perfect thing? No, it was not. But was it the correct ethical posture to take? Yes, it was. And then in contrast to that, you have President Trump exchanging military salutes with a North Korean general. And I just wonder what would have happened if President Obama had engaged in that sort of behavior.
Gotcha, Pedro. Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, I would add to what Pedro's point. You know, this week, as Fabiola pointed out in her column, Senator Marco Rubio lashed out at the media for our supposed hypocrisy, you know, that saying that while we noted President Trump's missteps in Singapore with Kim, that we never noted, you know, Obama's missteps. Now, well, in fact, we did. I think Fabiola and David will remember that we all called out Obama for making that chummy visit to a baseball game with Castro during his visit, which was just not a good photo op. And so we did call out his missteps as well.
Fabiola, is this a selective memory by the junior senator of Florida?
Absolutely. And that's the part of his politics. He plays up to different sides. You know, they call it here in Miami the little Marco dance. And it's, you know, he'll start by taking one side, and then he'll, you know, you'll think he's really going there and he's really going to do it. And then he flips and, you know, works the other side. And then he quotes a Bible passage. So, you know, but it works for the kind of people that he, you know, that he's trying to talk to.
Now, while he did point out what he deemed to be the hypocrisy of many in the media with the double standard of the coverage of President Trump in North Korea compared to President Obama in Havana, President Trump with North Korea, pardon me, not in North Korea, but with North Korea. Senator Rubio has also expressed some pretty significant skepticism about what the president walked away from in Singapore. So he has not been glowing necessarily in his assessment of what of the foreign policy practice of what the president was able to negotiate.
Right. But if you read his tweets every day, like I do.
You get paid to do it, Fabiola. Yeah.
And you study the way when he really, really means something and really attacks someone, it's very different from when he does not directly attack Trump for engaging with North Korea. And he's just he's doing the skeptic. He's playing the skeptic's role. But he's by no means, it's not a direct attack on Trump the way he lashed out at Obama.
And yeah, that's why I call Rubio's hypocrisy Rubiocracy. There's that nuance that mm-hmm. Fabiola is talking about that's very important here.
Okay. We got plenty more folks on the phone call, 800-743-9576. Greg in Miami on line three, you're up next. You're on the radio, Greg. Go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up with what the speakers were saying as far as the hypocrisy, because it's very frustrating to see you know, that it seems like the only thing we're consistent with is with being hypocritical. and it's so frustrating because, you know, so many of our presidents try to come off as if they're doing something for a more moralistic cause, when in reality it's just some selfish alternative motive. And the last thing I wanted to say is, in light of Jeff Sessions trying to invoke, you know, biblical scripture and whatnot, I right away comes to mind something that Jesus said, and I think it was actually to politicians or to the legal scholars at the time, which was that on the outside they try to appear as righteous, but on the inside they're full of hypocrisy and wickedness. And that to me is so applicable to everything we're talking about. You know,
Greg, we appreciate that. I want to get David Adams' thoughts on this consistency at hypocrisy that Greg has mentioned. Maybe that tells us more about voters who make selections for their political leaders than it does about the political leaders themselves, in terms of kind of situational ethics guiding foreign policy engagement.
Well, you know, I think in pure terms, there's no question that what we're witnessing is hypocrisy. But I suppose we also ought to put it in some context, in the sense that this is not an area where Donald Trump reigns supreme. There is plenty of competition in the political hypocrisy stakes in domestic and in foreign policy. And, you know, right now, today, we have an extraordinary crisis in Nicaragua. At the OAS meeting recently,
The Organization of American States,
not one single country in Latin America was willing to stand up to Daniel Ortega and call him out for the appalling atrocities that are being committed there on a daily, I should say, particularly nightly basis. And the United States actually was the one carrying the torch for Nicaraguan democracy, with some support from Canada. But you know, it was extraordinary to see Latin America let the Nicaraguans down.
And David, the question then is, would it be easier perhaps for us to, as I said before, get the rest of the region on board with us if they weren't alienated by things like this hypocrisy that we've just been talking about? Because, as I said, they don't just see the United States treating the island of Cuba this way. Again, psychologically, they take it as an indicator of how we treat the entire region. Would it be easier if we weren't, if our tacit point man on Latin America right now under Trump, Marco Rubio, weren't conducting this kind of hypocrisy? Would it be easier for us to deal with the region in instances like this?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually, you know, given the fact that Marco Rubio has been somewhat critical of the North Korea deal, that in actual fact there are worse offenders than him. If you look around the U.S. Congress, he's one of the few people actually who've offered any kind of criticism, and he's criticized President Trump on his Russia policy too. So on foreign policy, I don't think Marco Rubio is really the worst culprit.
Back to your phone calls, 800-743-9576. We'll go to Pompano Beach next on line 6. Janelle, thanks for holding on. Your thoughts. You're on the radio.
Thank you. Hi. I was calling to discuss how important it is for U.S. to normalize relations with China. I'm sorry, with Cuba. A lot of people don't really realize how China has such a strong hold along our eastern seaboard, by owning the deepest seaport in the Bahamas and the largest airport. So it's very important that we have better relationship with Cuba, and it certainly wouldn't behoove us if Russia or China had a better relationship with Cuba than we do.
Interesting comment there, Janelle. I will put that to David and Tim and Fabiola here. Really talking about engaging with Cuba from kind of a national economic interest standpoint, with China, who has been very active putting together ports and other trade relations in the Caribbean basin, in all likelihood to try to, you know, have kind of a staging area to gain access to the east coast of South America. Tim?
No, I think Janelle raises an excellent point. I mean, look, this is not 1962. Cuba is no longer pointing Soviet missiles at us. It's a completely different context in terms of national security. And I think it is in our interest, again, to engage Cuba, not give it a pass on human rights, but engage Cuba so that we do at least have a foot in the door there that would help us perhaps repel a little bit that that ingratiation that Russia and that we see Russia and China making with Cuba again and again Russia and China the reason we want our foot in that door is because we don't want Russia and China in this hemisphere undermining democracy through social media and all the other shenanigans that we've been seeing in recent years.
Fabiola, let me ask you about a report that came out this week from the Cuban Commission for Human Rights. And it looked at short-term detentions on the island and folks that have been detained because of political reasons. And it found that the number of those kinds of detentions has dropped 40% compared to the last year of the Obama administration. Is that evidence? So in other words, the Cuban government is detaining political prisoners at a far slower rate. Is that a positive impact of the Cuban isolation policy that President Trump announced a year ago here in Miami?
I don't think it has to do with that. I think it has to do with the events in Cuba itself, the fact that there is a new president, even if Raul Castro is very much a part of the scene. And I think it also has to do with the rise in detentions that we saw under Obama, because there was a lot of the dissent also increased during Obama.
Yeah,
you know, with
right.
the opening, they also yeah. got bolder. They, you know, the ladies in white went out to walk every single Sunday in front of tourists, and there were, you know, people there videotaping the arrests, and I also think that it's also the effect of people having cell phones and videotaping everything. I think the Cuban government realizes that everything that happens on the island is pretty much now videotaped. I mean, as we saw with the plane crash, we had photos as things were unfolding and
yeah.
video.
Yeah.
So I think there are other dynamics that really don't have to do with Trump.
The travel industry has certainly been affected in the past year with the Trump administration's move toward a bit more isolation. The Cuban government announced that travel by Americans into Cuba down 57% in the first quarter of this year. Year over year. So a significant drop there as the administration has taken a much different tact. Javier is in Miami on line four, who has some experience with travel. Javier, go ahead.
Hi, I was in Cuba recently, and what I found when I was going down there on the cruise ship, you know, they tell you you gotta say why you're going down there. So, you know, you say you're going for people-to-people exchange or you're going to visit family. I have family. I was saying I was going to visit family. They were trying to discourage me from saying that. And what I came to realize is that I think the policies that were put in place are self-serving for business interests back here in the U.S. because any company that you agree to take a tour on has to be affiliated back here. So something that you might pay $20 or $30 for down there now costs $150 to $300 for a small little tour. You know, and up, I saw people for $3,000. So I found that very interesting. I think those policies are really self-serving by business interests.
Javier, we got it. Thanks for that perspective. Much appreciated there. We're going to leave
Thank
our
you.
Discussion there. Javier, you get the last word. Our thanks to our guests here. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Fabiola Santiago, columnist for our partner, the Miami Herald. David Adams, senior editor for Univision. To all three of you, always great to have you on the floor to round up. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Lots more to come here. Stick with us on the roundup. World-class soccer will be coming to Miami. We know that for certain, probably in 8 years. World Cup. Will MLS come before that? 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup this week on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. It has been 4 years now since David Beckham came to Miami to say he bought a Major League Soccer franchise and hoped to bring it to Miami. It's been 6 months since Major League Soccer officially awarded a new franchise to Miami, but there's no date for a kickoff. But in June of 2026, there's a good chance Miami will host a professional world-class soccer match, World Cup soccer. The tournament comes to North America in 2026, and Miami could be one of the host cities as one World Cup gets underway halfway across the globe. Are you excited for the matches to come to South Florida in 8 years? Will MLS kick off sometime before that? Miami-Dade County, a home of MLS in the future and always will be. Is that where we're at here? Global Soccer and South Florida, 800-743-9576. John Devine is back with us, the assistant sports editor for our partner, the Miami Herald. John, welcome back. Nice to have you on again.
Nice to be back.
So let's talk about World Cup 2026, first of all. There's a list of cities in Mexico, the United States, and Canada that could host a match. What are Miami's chances of getting at least a match in 8 years?
I think the chances are very good, including the rumor is even a semifinal. When Stephen Ross redid Hard Rock Stadium, and even before that when Joe Robbie built it, he built it with international soccer in mind. Probably pretty much culminating in what you may see in 2026. Stephen Ross also followed up, and he has made it very amenable. As you can see, you've had the International Champions Cup, and they will have more premium international soccer. They even have Champions Cup Premier League friendlies here, just for that in mind, to expose them to international soccer. South Florida does very well in the international soccer market.
So who's the competition for 2026 and other cities that we'd be running against?
Well, I think some of the places you have, you have, it's a combination of the stadium itself and soccer and the hotbed of soccer. So California obviously will be one. And if you think about, almost think of it like a Super Bowl. And when I say that, like the stadium in Arlington, Texas, where the Cowboys play, great amenities, great soccer. I mean, a lot of soccer fans, proximity to Mexico, so it wouldn't be too far for them to travel. Same thing with California. Especially the new stadium up in near San Francisco where the 49ers play.
Right, Super Bowl was there recently as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Outstanding facility.
Yeah.
Now this facility is near that class. There may be some age in terms of the structure of it or the bones of the facility, but everything else has been revamped.
In terms of the Hard Rock Stadium here in Miami,
yes,
as a competitive location for it. So all this is happening. It sounds like odds are pretty good that Miami is going to enjoy some kind of World Cup match in 2026. Will Miami see an MLS homegrown team before then, John?
Well, they should. The biggest problem is it's whether they will have a stadium, I think, by 2026. I think plans are afoot. They Carlos Jimenez, he was on another radio station, did a couple of interviews.
Mayor of Miami-Dade County.
Yes, and he is on the record saying they're scheduled to play. Now, where, you know, originally they were talking about going to Overtown, and that is stalled. The Moss brothers are involved with ownership, so they've been looking at other facilities in other places.
If we want to go even further back, originally it was Port Miami, and then it was near Bayside, and then it was near Overtown, and then it was near the airport. So we continue to kind of move west, frankly, away from the water, which is what Beckham originally wanted to do. But does this World Cup, did the World Cup odds of Miami being a host city help, hurt MLS's efforts and David Beckham's efforts to try to secure a stadium location?
I think, to be honest, the answer is neutral because they're separate soccer. They're separate soccer. When I say that,
sure,
MLS fans here and international soccer fans are a lot different. You will have some who will support one or the other. Like, you will have MLS fans who will definitely support World Cup. But whether those World Cup fans, you may get 40, 50,000 for Peru and Chile in Hard Rock Stadium, but that doesn't mean that 40 and 50,000 will necessarily support MLS.
I guess maybe the question is, you've got back to the stadium, which is a big magnet here, a big draw for World Cup organizers. You know, what, 70,000 plus in a relatively new facade of a stadium with a soccer-hungry demographic here. On one hand for World Cup, but then for MLS, you know, it's a much smaller facility that the MLS franchise and David Beckham and his investment team are going after.
Correct, because I think what they want to do is whatever size facility you have, you want to give the impression that you have sold it out.
Yeah.
I know that the facility in Atlanta, you know, and even that they're using the new Mercedes-Benz Stadium, and it's new, so they've had like upwards of 50,000 people. But I think the best comparison may be Orlando and Orlando City. They have a soccer-only facility, actually located in an area that resembles Overtown. Mm-hmm. It's a historically African-American area and district. They got the land cheap, and it's put in there, and it's done well. It's like it doesn't hold 50 to 70,000.
Right.
It holds a smaller thing.
Yeah.
But it's full. And if it's full, and even if they can make it a must-go-to or must-see event, I think they will consider that a success if they can do it at 20 and 30,000.
John Devine is our striker here, Miami Herald's assistant sports editor with us from our Doral studios. John, great to have you on the Roundup. Thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
Finally, on the Roundup this week, before the 2026 World Cup, FIFA's 21st World Cup tournament is officially in play. And for the first time since 1986, Team USA is not on the pitch. That'll likely make a few soccer fans here in South Florida free agents to root for other teams. So we asked, who are you cheering on this year?
My name is Michelle Rubio, and I live in Miami, Florida. I will be going for Brazil and Spain this World Cup because in my household, where my husband's Chilean, we really don't have anyone else to root for. U.S., Chile are out. I also really love Italy, but they're also out. So it looks like Brazil or Spain have to bring it home.
This is Ricardo Rivera from Miami, Florida. This year we'll be cheering for Spain since the USA is out and we happen to be dual citizens.
Hi, this is Crystal from Boca Raton. If I can't go for the US, even though we very much wish we could this year, I still always root for Colombia. I was born in this country, but blood ties are still very strong.
Hello everyone, my name is Fabricio Rivera and I am from Miami. Very sad the US didn't make it this time, but I will be cheering for Iceland because of their winning attitude. I think it compares a lot to the American attitude. It has been the smallest nation to qualify for the World Cup ever.
My name is Alisa Keenan. I'm calling from Miami Lakes. This year for the World Cup, I will be cheering on the team for Panama. I am Panamanian, and this is a very historic moment for our team. We have never gone to the World Cup, and this is our first time there. The story of the Panamanian soccer team is really a Cinderella underdog story. And let's be honest, who does not like a Cinderella underdog story?
You can find more comments at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement editor, engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zabka. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.